Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to Close Reads here on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. I am David Kern, and as always on Close Reads, I am joined by Angelina Sanford and Tim McIntosh. How's it going, guys?
We're ready to rumble.
I love the fanfare, David.
Yeah,
that's what you sound like. You love it. I love the fanfare.
I love the fanfare, David. It is so meaningful.
I can see those acting classes have come in handy.
Well, he's
you're really emoting right now, Tim.
He's actually doing a role. He's in character.
Forrest Tim, Forrest McIntosh.
Yeah, for boring robot character. That's what he's.
Yeah,
yeah.
Boring robot character number one.
Run, Tim, run.
So, Tim, you're in Iowa City, Iowa at the moment in the Great Tim Adventure
that
of 2017.
Sounds fake. That sounds fake.
It's really true. And David, you said off the air that this is where Marilyn Robinson lives.
Well, I assume so. That's where the University of Iowa is.
So you're stalking her now?
So I'm just going to pay her an uninvited visit. Nothing wrong with that.
You're going to just barge into her office and be like, hey, I'm Tim McIntosh. And just look
you
at
probably know me from Close Reads.
You might know me from such shows as.
I'm pretty sure she's got Google set up to automatically alert her anytime someone's talking about her anywhere.
Yeah, I bet Wendell Berry does the same thing.
Oh, Wendell Berry's cell phone is constantly going off of notifications for.
Wendell Berry has someone who drives in from town, out of town,
and prints out the Goodreads reviews and hands it to him.
So Lori from Kansas City had a problem with how you ended Nathan Coulter in 1977. Then he goes out to his writing workshop and tries to figure out how to fix Lori's problems.
Gosh, doesn't that sound like just some fine bit of hell? Doesn't that just sound awful?
No, he like lines up bottles and he throws rocks at him because now he's mad at Lori.
Oh,
what does
man.
She think she is?
Yeah, he gets his 22 out and he puts old glass Coke bottles on a fence and he writes the word Lori on across the label.
Yeah.
But we are getting carried. This scene is just taking a life of its own. The three of us need to write a one-act play. Just see where it goes. No rules.
Well, speaking of no rules, we are here to talk about Murder on the Orient Express, the Agatha Christie novel. This is episode 2 of our Murder on the Orient Express conversation. And it's something pretty funny happened. So there is another Christian book podcast out there. Not books by Christians, but there's another group of Christians who are doing a podcast on books called The Bookening. I don't know if you guys know them.
No.
And they follow us on Twitter and we follow them and so forth. So when I posted on Twitter that we were talking about this book, they said something like, come on now, there's already a Christian podcast that's talked about this book. And they have, and it's pretty good. So you go listen to the Bookendings conversation on this book as well if you want to have some more, if you can't get enough Murder on the Orient Express. But then I responded with something like, what is this, one of those, this town ain't big enough for the both of us situations? And then somebody else is on Twitter posted a gif of like somebody like eating popcorn really fast. So apparently this is like, I think this is turning into like the Christian literature podcast skirmishes or something like that.
Loser leaves town.
No.
How long ago did they do it, David?
I can't remember how many weeks they did. They kept, every time we'd post about Gilead, they'd be like, another episode on Gilead. Oh, that book is
We're
just so
reading closely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what I said. They were like, that book is just so Gilead-y.
That is true.
It is true. It's very Gilead-y.
It is Gilead-y.
So anyway, check them out if you want to hear another interesting conversation about this book.
I feel like I need to get a Twitter account just so I can go comment on this.
Well, I'm kind of embarrassed that you don't already have one. How are you going to get Karis famous if you don't have a Twitter account?
I know, or an Instagram. I'm in trouble.
Her daughter always says that, like, you're not real famous because you don't have an Instagram page.
Yes, according to my 12-year-old daughter, the definition of fame is 5 million Instagram followers. And so she burst my bubble so bad the other day when she said, "Mom, Wendell Berry is not famous. He doesn't have any Instagram followers." And part of my soul died right in that moment. Parenting failure.
She was telling me this morning that someone came up to her and talked to her about Close Foods or whatever. And she was like, "Mom, you're not real famous. You don't have a lot of Instagram followers."
That's right.
Close Reads Famous isn't Instagram famous.
That's right.
Which is true.
It's totally true.
We're fine with that.
I don't think there's any possible way I could get 5 million Instagram followers.
Yeah, probably not.
Even if I did something crazy like, "I'm going to swallow a sword," or one of those crazy YouTube videos where people get killed.
You went there.
I don't know. I just think of the crazy, you know, never mind. Back to books.
So, Tim, where...
This is why I don't have an Instagram.
Where is next? So, Iowa City on to...
Chicago. Chicago tomorrow.
What's in Chicago?
Well, I am going to see a couple of theaters, hopefully meet with a couple of artistic directors, and I actually have a writing client, a fairly large college in Chicago. I probably should not mention their name. And I'm doing some research and interviews.
The University of Chicago?
Yeah, have you heard of them? No, not the University of Chicago.
The Chicago Manual of Style. You're working for them. You're there. You're the editor of the editors.
Oh gosh, no! They don't want that. They want to stay.
Can you imagine behind
the
job?
I was just thinking that. Can you imagine? We're all groaning. Our listeners are like, "What are you talking about?" Just imagine being the copy editor of the Chicago Manual of Style. Oh my goodness!
Like you get hired. You're like, "Oh, I know all about this. I know all the copy editing manuals." And then you start editing them, and like your boss comes and like, "Why are you making all these changes?" And you pull out your MLA. You're like, "You're fired. Get out.
It's been nice to know.
We're never going to get this episode either.
This is never going to happen.
Okay, I do have one question for you guys. That's at least in the suburbs of Close Reads. You've taught writing classes before. Since I started teaching writing, that when people think of writing, they think, I take a writing class so I can learn where to put the commas, what should be italicized and what should be put in quotes, you know.
Is that what people are doing?
I think that's kind of the default position that, I think that's what people think writing is. And I just want to say from the get-go, man, I am not terribly good at any of that stuff. I mean, I've learned how to do it, but sometimes I'm still like, man, I don't know if a comma goes there or not.
Well, I used to be an editor at a publishing house, so I do know where the stinking commas go, let me tell you. And I was like having PTSD talking about the Chicago Manual style, because immediately I'm like, which edition? Because that's always my follow-up question. Which edition do you follow? Yeah, because that's how nerdy I am. But yes, yeah. So it's awful. And editing and writing is not the same thing. Let me tell you what took the shine off of that for me was actually being an editor at a publishing house and getting manuscripts, and you're like, this guy can tell a story, but I'm not really sure he's literate.
Yeah.
Is the English language his first language? You know, and then I got to get in there and I got to make it be American.
Yeah.
American's not a language, you know.
American is a language.
Well, some of the characters in the Murder on the Orient Express might beg to differ.
Oh my gosh. Oh, very, very. I love it. Kinder. I'm very scared.
So we need to just take care of a little bit of business here before we dive into the show, because as you might recall, we have something we're giving away.
How many people answered it right? Sorry, I asked a question. It's loading.
I'm trying to reload the page to make sure that we get the final count. So, last I checked,
we literally have an hourglass spinning on the page right now.
Yeah, no, I do. Okay, here we go. Last I checked, there were like 40 something correct answers.
Ooh, nice job, Close Readers.
So, though the poll was, which Edgar Allan Poe story is considered the first detective story? Angelina, you know the answer to this. But first, Tim, do you know the answer to this? Would you like the options that we gave people?
I would love the option.
Oh, wait, it was multiple choice? Oh, that's not even fair.
Well, we, you know, it's easier to do it this way.
You should have let me make the multiple choice. I could have made them, well, like, so terrible.
I will. Well, we just chose from his stories.
Oh, okay, okay.
And then I voted the first vote, and I purposely voted the wrong one to lead people astray.
Ooh, David, that's devilish.
So the option, okay, which Edgar Allan Poe story is considered the first detective story? And here are the options that you have. The Telltale Heart. The Murders in the Rue Morgue. The Pit and the Pendulum. The Gold Bug. Or the Black Hat.
Whew, I would guess the Gold Bug, but I do not know.
And you would be wrong.
The correct answer is, I hope you and I are on the same page.
Ooh, the Murders on the Rue Morgue.
Yep, it is the murder.
And talk about a plot twist. Should I not? I won't spoil it.
Go ahead. It's like 700 years old. Not
it's
really.
Like a gorilla, right? It's not even a person.
Yeah, it was the first time that a detective, like, you literally could have made anything up, and like 99% of the listeners out there be like, it's an alien?
It was a robot. So then it was a robot that killed everybody.
It was the first story where a detective, where it set up the idea of a detective who logically kind of follows the clues and then, you know, using reason solves the crime. Like the precursor to Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot. And
I feel like my world is crumbling. That means an American invented the detective story.
This is true. It's 1841 or something like that, too. So, okay, Tim,
yes,
I need
sir.
You then. I need you to choose a number between 1 and 44.
Okay, so take your 12-sided die out.
So between the number 1 and the number 44.
Well, there's only two possible answers. One of them is Michael Jordan's number 23, and one of them is my dad's college number 32. I'm going to choose randomly between those two and choose Michael Jordan's number. 23 is the number.
Okay.
So you love Michael Jordan more than your dad?
I wouldn't say that.
But one of them was better at basketball.
One of them was slightly better at basketball.
Oh, yeah. I just said slightly. I didn't mean to imply anything. The winner is, drum roll, please. Angelina's doing a drum roll with pens on the desk. The winner is Kim Pyle. So congratulations, ooh, Kim. You won a copy of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. So congratulations.
Is she not going to hear this until we post this close reads?
It'll go up on Friday. I mean, we could always, I mean, I'll email her and tell her. But
yeah.
No, if you don't listen, you don't win.
Yeah. I'll just email her and tell her to listen.
I feel like somewhere Matt Bianco is crying because we've gone 40 minutes of banter, but
Matt doesn't listen.
Because he doesn't like the banter.
So, okay, let's dive in then. Let's skip the rest of the banter that we had planned, right?
But the banter is so much better than my discussion of the book.
So we're Murder on the Orient Express Part 2. And Tim, have you been following, as you travel across the country, any of the conversation on the Close Reads Facebook group about this book?
A little bit, but not much. I feel like I'm out of everything. So what's happening?
So, well,
oh, so much.
We want to build some of this conversation for today around some comments.
Oh, yeah. I've got my phone right here for work purposes.
Angelina did some, quote, research.
By reading the Facebook page.
By reading people's Facebook comments. And people have some amazing things that I think will lead to some really interesting conversation.
We have the serious best listeners. They're, like, pulling out chapter and verse. They're researching this stuff.
So let me hear. Hold on. Tell me what the idea is, David.
Yeah, so Angelina, I'm going to let Angelina present. It's Laura's, right?
This is Laura Lucht, longtime listener and poster on our Close Reads page. So she picked up on this idea of, you know, that detective stories, they're bigger. They're making a bigger comment than just the entertainment story, right? So she starts researching every geographical location that's named, all the countries where the characters are from, and she starts pulling together this whole post-World War I nationalism and that each of the so Yugoslavia being stopped, a murder happening in Yugoslavia, that's an echo of the murder of Sarajevo that sets off World War I, right? Like, good stuff. Everyone should just go join the Facebook page right now and read her whole comment. So each of the places are actually very significant in terms of the war. And so just to sum up, you're getting the sense of the frailty of the peace and a frail stability, a very frail post-war stability in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. So Syria being, so Aleppo is mentioned, that's a big one. Constantinople, Smyrna, you've got all these locations. And so even the train passengers themselves are almost the players in the war, the countries that are in the war. Like they're all represented. And so it seems like you've got a lot of other things going on. Even the Orient Express itself was an emblem of trying to rebuild after the war and pulling it all together and that kind of stuff. Lots, just amazing research and comments here about just the frailty of all of it. And particularly, we talked in the first episode about the question of what is justice and how are you supposed to feel when it's a bad guy that dies. And so she pulls that even into the war context of you've got so many things happening, ethnic cleansings and countries at war, and it becomes extremely difficult to know what is just mm-hmm. in these situations mm-hmm. and who is the victim and who is the perpetrator, and that's all really blurry. So you've got a lot of things going on. The rise, so post-war instability, the rise of ethnic nationalism, which you definitely see her playing with this in this book, right? Like, if you didn't know that she's making a comment about ethnic nationalism, it looks like she's playing stereotypes really hard. Like, it's bad writing almost. Oh, the Italian, he's passionate, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or the American, sweet, but not so smart, which is spot on. But
there certainly is the suspicion in the characters, right?
Yes.
Does it feel to you like they play that up a little too much sometimes, though? Like that they play up their suspicions of other people to a degree that is probably like to try to cast, you know, suspicion on other people on the train, they and kind of steered away from themselves. They rely on stereotypes and things like that to try to just draw the attention elsewhere.
Well, I think she's deliberately drawing attention to the form. And so I highlighted several lines where they seem to be playing on that. And Hercule Poirot could almost predict who was going to be and who wasn't going to be. And it can't be the Italian. It's too obvious. And this is not a passionate crime. It's too obviously pointing to him, so it can't be him, which that's what we've talked about. That's the whole plot. And that's the form of a detective story. And he keeps, our detective keeps pointing out the form of the detective novel, right? Oh, no, there's too many coincidences. Oh, no, it can't be her because we expect it to be her. And just all these kinds of things. But one more thing I wanted to add about this idea that we're getting a cross-section of the countries of World War One. Again, Laura pointed this out on the Facebook page, was that line in the first section when Hercule Poirot is told that the Orient Express is full, he responds, "All the world has decided to travel tonight."
Huh.
So she seems to be, I think what we're seeing happen is that she's drawing attention to the form, but she's also drawing attention to the themes, and they're all going together.
So Tim, do you buy this idea that she's creating an allegory of World War One?
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. I may be primed for this because the other book that I've been listening to while I've been traveling, in addition to Murder on the Orient Express, is a delightful book called Dead Wake. Do you guys know Dead Wake?
Yeah. It's about I've heard of it.
By Eric Larson.
Yeah, the Lusitania owner.
The Sinking of the Lusitania.
Yes, please tell me if it's good because that's on my library list.
Eric Larson is amazing. His books are always good.
He's amazing. This is a 5-star book. I don't know how the book could be any better. So people who don't know the story of the Lusitania, it's one of the fastest and biggest pre-World War One ocean liners, passenger liners. And as it was nearing the Irish, as it was nearing Ireland on its way to Liverpool, it was gunned down by U-20, a German U-boat. And the United States, so many, many Americans were killed, and the United States was not in the war. Woodrow Wilson had run on a peace platform. He did not want to enter World War I, but the Lusitania basically was kind of the event that got the U.S. in the war, even though it took another couple of years. The Lusitania was basically the event. What's really interesting, this is just so interesting, and then we can get back to the book. It really looks like Winston Churchill, who was for a time the head of Her Majesty's Navy, it really looks like Winston Churchill might have set up the scene so that U-20 would have basically open, unguarded waters and have a chance to sink the Lusitania, because Churchill knew that if something like the Lusitania went down, the Americans would get involved in World War I, and without the Americans getting involved in World War I, England was not sure that they could win. So it looks it looks really bad for Churchill in this, but it's just, I've been thinking about World War I and all the different things that went into it, and sure, it's absolutely plausible, especially a year before World War II when tensions are beginning to run high again. It makes sense that, you know, an author as esteemed and intelligent as Agatha Christie might set up...
And she does have a personal connection to the region as well. Her husband was an archaeologist in there, so she has more than a run-of-the-mill knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of her books takes place as a murder at an archaeology dig, I think.
Oh, and apparently she wrote a book on Syria.
Mm-hmm.
When I was listening yesterday, it really jumped to the forefront how much these kind of profiles of different nationalities seem to be so emphasized in the conversations between Poirot and Constantine and Bouc. It seems they're really preoccupied about that.
But even... I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
I was going to say, this is a reasonable account of why, of what's going on in the narrative that would make them highlight these different nationalities so much.
And that's true also just within all the other passengers as well. Like they're
speaking the same way. Yeah.
The detective, I mean, Poirot, Bouc, and Constantine are certainly drawing conclusions and interpreting evidence, you know, through a lens of that looks at each of those people according to their nationality, but also the characters and their prejudices. You know, this second part in particular was consumed with the way all these different characters thought about each other and looked at each other.
Yes.
Or didn't look at each other. But so this whole idea, like, I'm kind of torn because, and then Laura, this is great research, but so I don't want to throw shade on Laura's
research.
But
this is classic David, that I walked in this morning really excited about this, and he was like, this is classic David.
Okay, so I like it, but this is my, like, it's like when people talk about how Lord of the Rings is an allegory for World War II, it's like my sensors go off. Because I don't think that's how we should be reading it.
Oh, I completely
agree. So, my hesitation is, let's avoid reading Murder on the Orient Express as, like, some allegory for World War I, so much as maybe, and, like, she's taking themes that are surrounding her, and ideas that she can't help avoid, excuse me, and creating a story out of that. She's looking at the world around her, and she's interpreting it within the context of her story, which is what great artists do, right? It's what F. Scott Fitzgerald does in The Great Gatsby, and it's what Homer does in the Iliad, right? Or Shakespeare does in Henry V. By the way, St. Crispin's Day today.
That's right. Friend of brothers.
We should have had Tim do a performance of the Crispin's Day speech.
Yes, right now from memory. Go. No.
Tim, maybe you should pull that up, and before we go today, we'll have you do that when we sign off. And then we can say we band of close reads brothers and sisters, mostly sisters. I want to, like, I think it's really interesting to think about it that way and understand the book that way and understand what she's doing that way. But I also hesitate, or I want, I don't know. I don't even hesitate. I insist that, like, I'm guessing she was not creating allegory.
And I don't know. Well, I mean, I didn't read Laura's comment as allegorical.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, I think that's when you see these things, people often have a tendency to say, well, then this means this. What's our one-to-one correlation?
Right. Oh, definitely.
And that's a great way to ruin a book.
You know, I'm not for that at all. I'm not for the Pilgrim's Progress way to read at all. That's blasphemy as much. And I love allegory, but that what you're describing, that one-on-one thing, that is actually, that's not allegory. That's That's something else. But
anyway, right, but that's how, I'm just saying that's how that's, we do it.
No, I agree. That's, I agree.
Because it makes it easy, right?
No, absolutely. And we're always looking for the key to the puzzle, like Flannery O'Connor says. We always want, you know, the secret code, and it's all going to unravel for us. But that's not how books are. But at the very least, we get a lot of motivation of why there's suspicion of foreigners.
Right. That's the great word there, I think. Motivation. Like, what is motivating these characters to act the way they are? Part of it is that there's the stuff on the surface, which I think is what Laura's drawing attention to. As readers, it's not on the surface, but it's on the surface of their world.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And then there's the stuff that's behind, wrapped up in the mystery.
And this helps me to understand why Mrs. Hubbard keeps saying this was supposed to be the safe trip. This was supposed to be the easy way to travel through this very unstable region, right? This is why she's so concerned about her personal safety, which to us, it just makes her sound like a paranoid old lady. But
yeah,
I mean, if you're traveling alone, a woman in the middle of a war-torn Eastern Europe, yeah, you can be nervous.
And Tim, I think what makes a great mystery or spy novel or whatever work is that there's two levels of intrigue going on. There's the stuff within the world, like if you're reading a Cold War mystery, a spy novel, there's the stuff within the world that is informing the way characters act the way they do. It's the motivation for characters in general, that sets the tone for the world. And then there's the drama within the specific elements of the mystery itself. And having those two things converge is what makes a mystery story successful. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I pulled up Laura's comments, the last paragraph. This train with its cargo of suspects forms a microcosm of the fragile peace in Europe, the uneasy balance between West and East. Please note, close readers, that these cities still figure in our headlines today. Mm-hmm. What responsibility do we bear the other passengers on our present train? That's a great closing quote or closing question. And to your point, David, it's operating. The story that we're reading is operating on two levels.
It is the Close Reads Facebook group has been much more, I don't know what the word is. I don't want to say useful. That sounds, that's the wrong
one. Finally useful is David's saying. They're finally carrying there. The whole point of this show was that we wanted people to research for us. That was the entire motivation.
We needed help. No, the group has been so much more
actively engaged,
fruitful, and I don't know all the different words you want to use.
I think it's awesome because I read these comments and I think these people are reading close.
Yeah,
and then they're, you know, they're bringing all this stuff, and I felt a little ashamed that I wasn't the one talking about the World War One connection.
It also,
I was shamed. You shamed me, Laura, but in a good way.
It also shows that there's at least six people listening.
Thank goodness. So, yes,
there's at least more people listening than the number of people on the show.
That was 2017 goal accomplished.
Hey Tim, as you'd never read this before, right?
Correct. But I had seen the movie. But I had seen the 74 movie.
Have you gotten past? Have you gone further than part one?
Yes. Further than part two, you mean?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. I have.
Have you finished the whole thing?
No.
Okay. So let's just assume we're going through part two. Has your sense of Poirot as a character changed at all?
Yes. He's temperamentally, I don't think he's terribly different than what I imagine him to be. But his capacity has deepened. You know, he is figuring out. He knows. I've gotten to the point where he basically knows, although the reader does not. He knows who has done the deed. You go into reading the book and you know the detective is great at what he does. He wouldn't be a famous detective if he wasn't great at what he does. I'm starting to see now his greatness, and I hadn't seen it in the first part.
I just want to say something before I forget. When we were talking about last week, the form of the detective novel, and that I thought that Agatha Christie is really, really drawing attention to it and is going to say something about the form. Like, I think that's one of the things she's doing. I forgot to mention, it's funny too. In my middle school class, I literally said, you always start with the front matter of the book. The front matter matters, right? I was, and then I skipped the front matter in this book. So I am my own worst student in this episode, apparently. But if we look at the front matter, which is the table of contents, we pay attention to the structure of the book, and we can see how much she's drawing attention. This is not typical of an Agatha Christie novel, that she's calling it part one, the facts, part two, the evidence, part three, Hercule Poirot sits and thinks. I mean, this is exactly how a detective story plods forward, but she's drawing our attention to it. And I liked in this section, too, how it said, well, normally we have all kinds of resources that we don't have available now. We have police to go check on people's alibis. And a lot of a detective story is footwork. And we saw that in Murder Must Advertise, right? You got to go out. You got to track people down. You got to interview them. You got to double check alibis. You go with the police. You run background checks on people. They don't have any access to that. So this is purely going to be mental. He's going to mentally solve the puzzle. But there's going to be, you know, there's not going to be fingerprints or DNA or, you know, there's not going to be anything like right. that. And he even talks about how we don't have to go track down the suspects. They're going to come to me one by one. So it's like this super exaggerated, organized, orderly, you know, he's sitting there with a checklist and bring in the next one. And then and right after each other. So it's very fast. So I guess it's like almost intensified in that it's shortened because we interview one person and then we kind of follow their plot line a little bit and find out more about who they are and their backstory and kind of meanders around and then that kind of fizzles out and then you chase the next lead. But this is all really, really shortened and therefore intensified.
Yeah, it is an interesting structure. Part one, crime. Mm-hmm. Part two, gather evidence. Part three, think. Like part three is even called Hercule Poirot sits down and thinks.
Yeah. Exactly. So what's
going to happen in part three, guys?
I'm pretty sure there's not going to be a chase scene like Hercule Poirot on top of the moving train running after the killer.
Well,
I don't remember that being. He's kind of a big guy. I don't see that happening. Also, his mustache might get tossed about.
Yeah, exactly. It might get curled the wrong way. Tim, if you could grow a mustache like that. Would you grow? Although no, maybe you can grow a mustache like not. That. I don't know.
I probably could. I don't think I will. As a courtesy to all of my friends and family, I will.
I'm just going to say this at the risk of insulting hipsters, which I am not trying to insult at all because I love me a good hipster. But having said that, somebody on the Facebook page was making the comment that Kenneth Branagh, who's going to be playing Hercule Poirot, that his mustache in the film is really, really exaggerated. And I thought, well, that's because there's so many hipster mustaches that look like he's going to have to just exaggerate it, don't you think?
He did an interview about it.
Oh, tell me. Of course, David knows the backstory of the mustache. Let me hear it.
So this is really interesting.
That's
my wife just texted me. And so I responded.
Yes, I'm looking over at a completely blank-faced David saying, that's interesting, while he's texting in his phone. This is close reading, y'all. Yeah,
I'm close reading my wife's text.
As a good husband should.
So she texts. It's about books, actually. She texted me where to find a recipe because she's trying to make soup for the kids who are sick. And I texted her that big cookbook back, and I meant to finish it by telling her who wrote it, because I couldn't remember the title of it, and she just wrote me back like, that big cookbook, what do you mean? They're all big.
Worst instructions ever. It's in the big book.
We have 40 cookbooks. They're all probably 400 pages or more, well, most of them. So anyway, so he got asked about this. He's like, why is this mustache so outrageous? And he says, well, in the series of books, not in this one, but in one of the books, she says that it was the largest mustache in England.
Oh, really? Wow.
And she hated the mustaches in all of the other versions on stage and screen.
Because she wants it to be exaggerated?
They were not big enough for her. They weren't curly enough. They weren't thick enough. There were not enough layers to it.
Wow.
So he in reading about what she thought of the other versions of Hercule Poirot, like she did not like Alfred, Finney, was it?
Alfred Finney, yeah. Albert Finney.
She was like, those were just little wisps. So he's like, we're going to do it right. So they did the biggest, most, like, you'd think, okay, that could be the biggest mustache in England.
Is it meant to be almost comical?
Well, I think so. I think that's the way she viewed it. And it's meant that he's vain, right?
Yeah.
And so he likes to be recognized. You see that in this book, right?
Oh, where, yes.
Like, he is taking account of how people respond when his name is said, because they don't come in the room and he's like, hello, I'm Hercule Poirot, we're going to talk. He like is very dramatic about it, right?
I presume you know who I am, madame.
Yeah, or like they'll talk and then they'll be like, who are you? And he's like, wait, he's like, oh, I'm so glad you asked.
I'm going to start introducing myself like that. At conferences, I'm going to stand up and be like, I presume you all know who I am.
So anyway, so the mustache is part of that vanity, right? Like he has to have the biggest, most grand mustache. Mm-hmm. And he's very careful. He is like as you said last time, he's got like tools
for his curling tongs.
So Kenneth Branagh spent almost a year trying to grow a mustache. And in the end, they didn't like how it turned out. So they shaved it off and it's the like a stick-on.
Oh.
It's a prosthetic. It's a prosthetic mustache.
Yeah, they like made a special one that was like fit what they wanted to do because he tried to grow it and like they couldn't get it to look right for months and months. So then he wasted months and months of upper lip growth.
What a man will do for his art.
I know.
Take one for the team right there, Ken.
Exactly. But it really does. I mean, it gets right into the character.
It fits into that.
It's a good reading of the character and also... You know, and kind
that he takes himself so seriously, but is also a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Tim, do you think that is he like you in that he takes himself seriously, but knows he's ridiculous and is willing
to
buy
into that? I didn't catch the second part of that. He takes himself seriously and
but knows he's ridiculous. Does he take himself seriously, but doesn't recognize his own ridiculousness?
I think he is. Very self-aware. I think he takes himself seriously and he knows he's a little bit
I'm trying to track with you. Do you say that based on like his comments of my little quirks, my little originalities, you know, his little, like he's drawing attention to, I know I got some weird stuff. Is that what makes you think that?
Yeah. And his maintenance of his mustache. That's also in evidence. His main. Well, I don't know. Maybe that would be evidence that he's terribly vain.
I'm not sure.
Well, he thinks he's vain.
I don't know that I think he's ridiculous.
So okay, let's.
That he thinks he's ridiculous.
How self-aware is Hercule Poirot? He is obviously self-aware to the degree that he understands that he is good at what he does. Right.
Right.
But isn't that sort of what we do in these kinds of characters? Like he can see everyone but himself.
So that's what I'm asking. Is that how you read it?
I was actually surprised to hear Tim say that he knows he's ridiculous because I think he doesn't know. I think he'd be deeply offended if someone said you're ridiculous. I think he'd be super offended.
I don't think that he's actually ridiculous. So I think that he knows that he's a little bit
odd.
Yeah,
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So he's not. So you both agree that he's not. Ridiculous.
He knows he's eccentric, but I think he likes that about himself.
How much of it do you think is natural and how much do you think is played up for a character? So, because he's playing a character.
That's a good question. I don't know. I feel like I need to read a bunch of these in a row. I've never done that. I mean, she's got what? How many novels does she have? There's 60-something Hercule Poirot novels or something, right? 40-something? It's a lot. And I have never read all of them, much less read them in order to see the development of the character, so... I really don't know.
I don't know either.
So Hercule Poirot, she wrote 33 novels, one play, and more than 50 short stories between 1920 and 1975.
Wow.
According to the Wikipedia.
Well.
Prolific.
Only the finest research here for you, ladies and gentlemen. David had his crackerjack research staff running around.
Yeah.
From now on, can we have Kirstie just sitting in the desk right there while we do it? And then I can just like nod to her. Like at a baseball game when you need stats.
Yeah.
Wait, what's this guy's?
We need a statistician.
You know, yeah. In the fourth inning when he's two outs and it's raining on a Thursday. Tell me what his average is. Quick.
Coming up now in the bottom of the third inning, Hercule Poirot with the bases loaded.
It's a little dust in his mustache. He's calling time out.
I think part of the reason that I think that Hercule Poirot is self-aware is because how could you ever actually solve a crime without being aware of kind of like all of the different impulses and passions that might lead you to, you know, want to chase one potential suspect over all the others, which is exactly what Book and Constantine, well, especially Book does when he's consulting with Poirot. Poirot will interview someone and that person will leave the room and Book will say, they're guilty. Clearly they're guilty.
And or his hang up with the Italian, his prejudice leads him to just.
Yeah, right. And I would think that Poirot has to be self-aware enough. I mean, surely those sorts of inclinations impact our detective, but he's self-aware enough that he waits, he bides his time, he continues to inspect.
So you think he can compartmentalize?
Well,
his own instincts.
I think he's aware of his instincts. He has to be self-aware of his instincts in a way that, like, Book is just so not self-aware.
I do think it's interesting that he knows he's being played.
Go on. What do you mean?
Well,
by the murderer?
By the murderer, right. So like when he says, let me tell you what's going to happen. We're going to find the woman's robe in a man's suitcase. I'm going to find the man's outfit in a woman's suitcase. And it's going to be this woman, the Swedish.
Mm-hmm. And if we find it in there, we know she's
not it. Yeah, because Book says, oh, so you think she's it? Oh, on the contrary, I know she's not. And that's why we're going. So again, all of that is drawing attention to the form and the way that the detective novelist thinks. But also I think he knows, because he says there are too many coincidences. There are too many clues. Like he knows that somebody's trying to deliberately take him in the wrong direction.
And then, of course,
he knows the pipe cleaner and the handkerchief were plants.
And he's trying to sort through what are the real clues and what are the fake clues.
Right, right.
And he, of course, the part two ends by him recognizing there's a game kind of going on.
Exactly.
He says, defiance.
Yes. And that was awesome, by the way, that they hid the robe in his suitcase. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
I like that. Dope move.
Dope move.
It's a baller move. It's a baller move, right? Yeah, is that what they say?
I don't know. We should probably try not to talk like our students.
I'm being relatable, David.
Oh, yeah. Good. So all of the high school kids who are listening are like, oh, I love Angelina now.
Oh, yeah. That's why you should love
you me. Guys, can I tell you something that happened in my online class on Monday? And I don't know.
Our listeners tell me they love a good Tim story, so go ahead.
Okay. This, I don't know that without the visual that you could recognize just how glorious a moment I had in my class on Monday.
This sounds amazing.
The background is I was speaking in Colorado Springs for Searcy, and I was staying with some friends of mine who all remain nameless, and their daughter takes my online class. Okay, that's the setup. Monday morning, we start class. And before we start class, I say to the daughter, I'll just use her name so it doesn't get too confusing, Sophia. I was like, Sophia, we should have fun with the rest of the students today because I'm going to be, you know, over in one room. You're going to be in another room. We'll only be separated by about like, you know, like 50 yards. And they don't know that we're in the same place. So let's have a little fun with them. She's like, okay, great. So, we start class and, you know, like we're kind of just starting up and I'm like, hey, you guys, by the way, speaking of current events, did you know that, you know, Google has come out with this new app and this new app, you know, like everybody has wanted to be able to email like actual stuff, not just text and pictures, but like email a pencil. And Google has finally figured it out. And I downloaded the app yesterday and they're like, what? And I said, yeah, it's a Google app. And one of the students is like, what's the name of the app?
Like,
I want
to
get it right
now.
They're trying to
do it right now. Oh, no, my students do that too.
And I said,
in the class, that person was going to have 7 pencils.
Right, exactly. He's going to like email a Coke to his friend or something like that. So I said, yeah, it's called like Google Material or something like that. But I downloaded it. None of you guys have heard of this. And Sophia now, who is, of course, in on the joke.
You're Willy Wonka at this point, right?
Yeah, somebody else mentioned Willy Wonka. Sophia says, oh, yeah, I heard about this app, too. I downloaded it last night also. And I was like, wait, are you serious? Sophia, let's try it. Let me try to, like, I'm going to try to email myself to you.
And she says, not Mike TV.
And she's like, oh, that's great. So, like, the online class, everyone can see everybody else. So, right? And it's kind of a Brady Bunch sort of setup on this app Zoom.
Yes.
We're all looking at each other and I'm like, okay, let's try it. And so I'm like acting like I'm pressing stuff on my phone.
I'm crying right now, just so you know.
Sophia is acting like she's so pressing stuff on her phone. And then I turn my camera off, so I disappear, and all the students are like, wait a second. Wait, where did he go? And Sophia is like, you can see her in the lower right corner. She's tripping. She's laughing so hard because she knows what's about to happen. So I run downstairs. I run down the hallway. And I like poise just outside of Sophia's camera frame. And then I leap into the camera frame with my phone. And you guys, you should have seen my students. Like, one of them, one of my students got so freaked out that they all saw me leap in. And they're like, oh, wait, what? What? And they all start freaking out. One of my students got so freaked out that he, like, closed his camera, I think because he was afraid that I might, like, teleport myself into his living room. It was... It's the best 4 minutes. I literally am afraid that if we just, like, separate the 4 minutes and put it online, that it will go... I think people will go bonkers for it.
Oh, my gosh. You have to. You have to.
I know. I really want to, but I think we need to get permission from all of the parties included before we do that thing. Oh, my gosh. I've watched it 15 times, and every time I watch it, I can barely contain myself.
But you at least need to send it to us now.
Yes,
okay,
I'll send it to you.
I'll send it to you.
We'll just tell the people on Facebook how cool it is.
Oh, my goodness. If I get permission, maybe we can post it on Close Reads because
oh, that's
I think
crazy.
People will get a real kick out of it.
That's hilarious.
Okay, oh, sorry. Sorry to interrupt, but I think that was a worthwhile interlude. Murder on the Orient Express is sort of like a tertiary subject of this podcast.
Tertiary, so third. It's third.
Yeah, not even second. Not even second.
What? Here's okay. Something else I thought was cool about the book. Can I segue?
Please.
Can I interrupt you, Tim, and talk about a favorite book I'm reading?
Please.
I'm reading this book right now. That's really cool. You might have heard of it. Murder on the Orient Express. I think a movie's coming out.
Let's talk about it.
If we have a few minutes, I wouldn't mind talking about it.
Go ahead. We can carve out a little bit of time.
So, obviously, we've got suspicion on Ms. Debenham and Colonel Arbuthnot, which I thought was so interesting in the way that Book says, oh, well, they must be in it together. And Hercule Poirot says, no, because, again, studying the psychology of these things, if they were in it together, she would be his alibi and he would be her alibi. But that is not what we have here. So, again, so many interesting things. And he, of course, is convinced it's a premeditated murder, not an act of passion, which why he doesn't buy the Italian.
Yeah, and Book and Constantine are keep bringing it up. And he's like, why can't you understand?
A passionate woman did this to this man.
Yeah.
Who is both left-handed and right-handed and strong and weak.
Well, I mean, ambidextrous.
Like all women.
All women are ambidextrous?
No, we are strong and weak and left and right-handed.
Oh.
We like to keep you off balance. You haven't figured that out?
I didn't know this about
things. Women. Oh, that was secret. Edit that out. Yeah. Edit that out.
Logan, get rid of it.
Yeah. Whoo, can't let that one out.
Tim, what were you going to say?
Oh, nothing. Nothing. I was just listening. Poirot is, I love that we keep coming back to this will be a psychological solution. I mean, sure, he's gathering facts, he's gathering evidence, but his inclination towards psychology, I think.
He's ruled out several people just based on they don't have the psychology to have committed this crime. But Mrs. Debenham, but he's fascinated with Miss Debenham because as far as he's concerned, she's the one person in this whole group who has the psychology to have pulled off something like this, something cold and calculating and premeditated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what I find interesting is that nobody here has, even Poirot, has come out and said, are these people who they are portraying themselves to be. Like, there's been no suspicion of maybe the Italian is playing up the role or the American is playing up the role of this.
Well, I think Book suggests, how do we know Hardman is who he says he is? And Poirot says, well, because it's too easy to disprove him once we get somewhere else.
Right. I guess I don't mean that they're presenting...
Oh, you don't mean an actual false identity.
Right, yeah, or...
That they might be showing the wrong psychology.
Right, yes. Yeah, like that Poirot hasn't even come up in conversation. And maybe it's just not that kind of book, and Agatha Christie didn't need to introduce every idea or every kind of
Well, I think
suspicion.
We see a little bit of that in the way that he talks to Miss Debenham, because he does not give her a straight-up interrogation. He tries to trick her. He's looking for an emotional response, and he gets one because she... She gives a very bad answer when he says, are you scared? Because Miss Hubbard is losing her mind that she's next door to it and that there's a murderer on here, right? She's scared, rightly so. Anyone would be scared. And so he says, you know, are you concerned about this? And she says, no, why would I be? And then he says, oh, crime is an everyday affair for you or something like that. It's just all in a day's work. I think that's how he puts it. She says, no, of course not. And then, of course, she also says the odd thing in response to, do you have a red dressing gown? She says, no, that's not mine. And he leans forward like he's pouncing like a cat. It says he's finally got something he can kind of sink his teeth into. So,
but of course, that's where, as someone who, if you read mystery novels a lot, you're like, okay, so maybe our suspicion, we are most suspicious as readers being in Poirot's head of Mary.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's something always like in your head is going ding, 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 like, too obvious. You know, like the obvious one is rarely the one who actually did it.
That's right.
And there's something else going on. So the layers of the suspicion are really interesting because you've got the suspicion that the passengers have for each other. And then Constantine and Book have their kind of suspicions. And then Poirot has his suspicions, but he's not really telling us who they are yet. And then as readers, we have our own suspicions based on the evidence and then how we interpret them as individuals. Each of us will have our own people that we're like sort of suspicious of. But then also the genre itself leads us to believe certain things and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you can... A good mystery writer, even when they're kind of subverting the themes, is still relying on the form.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Which, and that's, you know, a good mystery story never completely tosses the form out the window.
Oh, and I don't think she's tossing it.
No,
I think she's drawing attention to it for her own purposes.
I wasn't saying that what you were saying. I mean,
right,
because you can take the themes and turn them upside down or the common tropes, but you still have to rely on the form or at least turn to the form to create your relationship as an author between the author and the book and then your audience.
Yes. I think that we can trust the form enough to know that one of the suspects is the killer and logic was going to figure this out. It's not going to be a deus ex machina, right? He's not going to find a hidden diary where someone confessed to themselves in a moment of panic. It's not going to be like that, right? The facts are in front of us. But I also think it's interesting because we talked last time about procedural dramas versus a true detective story. And one of the things that's true about a procedural is that CSI would always say, I follow the evidence. Because people say, well, why? That's leading you to this person. That person couldn't have done it. And the answer is always, I don't ask those questions. I just follow the evidence. And here we have the reverse of that. Poirot's psychology is telling him something's off with Miss Debenham. But everyone else is pointing out, but the evidence is not there. And he admits the evidence is not there. And that's what's puzzling so much. Because if she did it, then this, this, and this should also be true. And that's not true. So there's no evidence to support it. But yet he won't give up because he's so convinced about the psychology thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an interesting kind of twist on storytelling that we see.
Tim, do you remember how the movie ended?
Yes, I do. Do I remember the solution?
Yeah, so you remember who the criminal was?
Uh-huh.
Okay, never mind then.
Were you going to ask me who I suspected?
Yes, I do too, so we all have to be so careful about what we say.
Well, can I say who I suspected when I was watching the movie? Would that help?
While you were watching it?
Yeah.
Don't spoil that Hercule Poirot is actually the killer in a sleepwalking film. Don't spoil it, Tim.
I won't say anything, because if I say something, that will... eliminate that person from consideration.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Oh, very wise. Sneaky. Monsieur McIntosh, you twirl your mustache so well.
You should write mystery stories.
David, do you remember who you suspected when you were reading it for the first time?
Ooh, I don't remember who I suspected.
Oh, me either. I'd have been
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Do you guys find that when reading a mystery story or a story that is about solving a crime or something like that, that you tend to be suspicious of a certain kind of character and maybe like have maybe some grace towards characters or other kinds of characters? So in other words, when you're reading stories, is there like an archetypal character or something that you tend to think, just instinctively, oh, that's the person that did it?
Like, and then, the butler? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I guess. But I'm thinking more like the psychology of characters. And then is there like a character where... are you sympathetic to characters that on the surface seem like they are the ones that should have done it? And I'm asking more about this, your own psychology as readers, I suppose. Like, if you're self-aware enough to even recognize this. I don't know if I am.
Are we sympathetic enough to
Well, let me put it this way. So you're, let's say you're reading a story that takes, that's a murder in, some rich dude gets murdered and then they bring in Sherlock Holmes or something to solve the crime. And you go through all these different characters and trying to figure out who it is. Is there a specific character, type of character that, you know, like, are you going to be, are you instinctively led to be suspicious of the butler or the pretty girl from the countryside or the, you know, the unrequited love or
okay, yeah. So I would say in those situations, if there's a woman who has been mistreated who's a suspect, I'm usually pretty sympathetic to that. Like, yeah, stab him again.
Are you suspicious? Like, would you be suspicious of her?
No, because I would think that's the too obvious quick solution.
Okay. What about you, Tim? Like, do you tend to feel like the obvious, like, do you instinctively say the obvious ones are just not it? Like, so would it be easy to trick you by making it the obvious person in the end?
It probably would be easy to trick me if it was the obvious person, because I tend to say the obvious person is not it. We have a detective story of 250 pages. It has to be someone who's not obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's one thing. You know, in real-life criminal investigations, they say that murder is actually the easiest crime to solve, and it's because it's an act of passion. It's not premeditated. It's usually pretty obvious who is the person in this life that would get, you know, angry enough. So it's, you know, it's someone close to them, someone who's not going to clean up after the crime. So there's usually lots of physical evidence. So we don't see that kind of stuff typically in a detective story, though. That's one of the reasons he's pointing out there's not going to be fingerprints on the knife. There's not going to be fingerprints on the window. In other words, this was not a careless moment of passion.
All premeditated.
This is a premeditated crime. Now, premeditated crime in which you cannot easily link the perpetrator and the victim are almost impossible to solve. Because there's no physical evidence, there's no motive. So I think that's why we end up seeing those stories, because those are the puzzles. Those are the hard ones. And that's what's so interesting is about in this story is all of the suspects are trapped. So even knowing it has to be someone, there is a connection here between someone and the victim. Whereas in a different scenario, you wouldn't necessarily know that. If you just found his dead body in London somewhere, you wouldn't know where to look. Which is, I mean, you know, but again, they draw attention to that. The secretary says, well, I know that I'm the suspect, so let's clear me out. And then somebody says, oh, it can't be you. You're too obvious. And then the same thing with the princess. Don't you suspect me? She says, I loved Sonia Armstrong. And he says, that's precisely why I don't suspect you. It's too obviously you.
If in some ways I kept thinking, man, it feels like he's drawing the conclusion that it's not someone too quickly.
Ah, maybe he is. Maybe that's part of the form that Christie is playing with. A few people have suggested that they don't think he's necessarily. A few people have suggested on the page that he's a little hasty.
That Poirot is a little hasty?
Yeah. In the conclusions he's drawing about people.
Well, to this point, he certainly is confident in his ability to.
Oh, he's very confident.
To reason his way through this, and that his conclusions and his understanding of psychology in particular are accurate and right.
Although this section did end with something he did not predict. He was right that the robe was going to be in a man's suitcase, but he did not guess it was going to be his own suitcase. And it not only surprised him, it pleased him. It was this kind of Sherlock Holmes, all the game is afoot moment. Like, oh, all right, check. I see what you did there. Okay, nice move. It was a little bit of respect, I thought.
Yeah, right. He's a worthwhile adversary.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. So he's so confident that even when something happens that he did not predict, he's not ruffled by it.
He needs liked it. Moriarty.
Yes. That's exactly right. He liked it. I read that in very, you know, wink in the eye. He liked it. He was excited about that.
David, it might be fun to have the close readers post on the Facebook page who they think, because we're going into section three, to post who they think did it and maybe a sentence about why.
Yeah, let's do that. So if you're on the Facebook group, then I'll post a thread. I'll just post a comment. We can do. People can leave comments responding.
And it's going
to
say, "Who done did it?"
Exactly. Who do y'all think done did it? And
no spoilers.
Just in keeping with where we are right now. And what we will do then is, if you've already read it, don't. Or if you already know who did it, don't respond. If you don't remember, if you've read it but don't remember, then you can respond. But just go based on your suspicions.
I still think it's a clear case of suicide.
That would be interesting.
All right. So what do you guys think about a handful of people, maybe like four or five people, have been uncomfortable with how quickly Hercule Poirot concluded that Ratchet was Cassetti? Now, for me as a reader, that was not a leap for me, and I had no problem. But what about you guys? There's several people who just thought, oh, no, that's, he finds a piece of paper that says Daisy Armstrong, and now he knows who this is. They weren't buying it. What do you think about that?
I think that this, I think that's what we're supposed to, I think we're supposed to feel like that was the clue combined with his other knowledge of the case, and that he was already suspicious of Ratchet ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that maybe he was drawing that conclusion and presenting it and then trying to see if how people responded to it.
By saying, this man is Cassetti.
Yeah. Like, was there anybody who's like, nah, or like some of the characters just were very like, oh, yeah, now that you mention it, you know, so that's part of my thinking on that. So he might be using it to play a game, and he had a hunch that he was playing to see if anybody was like, oh no, or whatever. Or if the secretary or the valet were able to point him in some other direction, or shoot that down, they'd be maybe some of them, perhaps the most likely, they'd be able to say, oh, he wasn't there at that time or anything like that, you know. That's my guess. But also, you know, you have to present things in a mystery story in a somewhat efficient way. So there are some limitations to the storytelling.
And the fact that of the setting, you know, if this was in a different setting, he would go to a newspaper office and look it up. There'd be that scene, but you can't have that here. So yeah. I think we just have to go with
it. I felt that. Like, I felt in the moment of rereading it, like, oh, that
did
seems
you feel
fast.
It was abrupt? Oh.
But that's why I started thinking, well, maybe that's part of the deal. Like, that's purposeful. What about you, Tim?
It did not strike me as abrupt at all. I thought that he was, it sounds like what you're saying, David, merely confirmed a deep hunch that he had.
Do you, you're listening to it, right, as you drive?
Correct.
So which audio version? Are you doing the Dan Stevens one or the David Suchet version?
Dan Stevens. I think it's Dan Stevens.
Dan Stevens is good.
The guy who does the voices is just terrific. I'll look it up. It's on my phone. I'll look it up.
The Dan Stevens one, he, you know, that's the guy from Downton Abbey.
What role is he in Downton Abbey?
Matthew.
The husband. The cousin.
The cousin. Really? The blonde dude. The veteran of World War
One.
Let's see.
Yeah, so that's I'm listening. I've got a couple audiobooks by him. I've got the first James Bond book. He reads that. Casino Royale, and he's really good, and he's done a number of other things. And there's like 25 or 30 audiobooks of his on Audible.
It is Dan Stevens.
So I'm wondering if...
Is he doing a French accent for Hercule Poirot, or how's that work? Is he just doing an English accent for everything?
No, he does it's good French.
It is kind of a French accent. It's muted with Poirot, and it's very good. It's not overly muted.
Is he exaggerating the American accents like she is in here?
he sounds the detective sounds straight up Texas. Just a big Texas boy.
Well,
I reckon.
Well, they did speak in a different way in America in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
They had a reputation for, you know, if you've listened to old audio recordings, there was a different way of speaking. We've kind of just in the last 100 years let our speaking just kind of fall into decline.
It's really funny if you can get an English person to imitate an American accent. It delights me to no end, because it does not sound at all what I think we sound like. But of course, to a Brit, it just sounds like all of the vowels are as big as a, you know, the Caspian Sea. They're just...
Did either of you ever watch the Jeeves and Worcester TV series?
With Hugh Laurie?
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Okay, so it's Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry, and they're Jeeves and Worcester, and they act out quite a few of the Woodhouse stories. It's a fantastic series, but the reason I mention it is because whenever they do have an American character on the show, it hurts my ears. Like, it sounds... I just think, ooh, that's the worst American accent I've ever heard. And it's probably like a real American, but it just... I don't know what happens in those moments is... I just...
Well, you settle into the British.
Is that what happens? You settle into the British dialogue, and then you hear the American... Am I hearing what the American accent sounds like to a British person
in
that moment?
We'll have to ask a professional.
Yeah, because it sounds awful. But then even there's some stories where Bertie goes to America. Mm-hmm. So in those stories, he's the only one with the British accent, and every American on the show sounds fake to me.
Maybe they're British people talking in America.
So either they're British actors with bad American accents, or something wonky happens to my ear when Americans are portrayed on a British TV show. I've heard other people say that too, though, so I don't know.
I'm trying to think of The Crown. In The Crown, does the president come, and is there any American characters?
But maybe, are they doing the older American accent in the Worcester ones? Is that why it sounds weird? I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway, well,
this is a hard podcast because we're right on the cusp of solving the crime.
We are. I'm so excited to find out what happens and how he's going to unravel this. I wanted to clap. That was so well played with the robe.
Yeah, it was. Well, we've gone over an hour. Let's start to wrap things up. Let's get some final thoughts. And then, Tim, we're going to announce. Don't go away after this break. We're going to announce the next book that we're going to do. And Tim's going to do a reading of Crispin's Day Speech, unless Tim can.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I don't know. I mean, I know that speech moderately well, but, you know, like part of the thing about being – it's like asking a violin player to just, you know, just go ahead and, like, fiddle it out for us. You know, you have to, like, understand the words pretty well. You have to understand the notes pretty well.
You can say no, Tim. Stand up for yourself.
I'm just kidding. I was just, you know – trying to give a reason for people to come back after the quote break. But yeah, we will do the let's get final thoughts, and then we're going to announce the next book. So I'll go with you, Tim. You first. What are your final thoughts on part two as we lead into the crime solving part three?
Where I will say, remembering when I was watching the movie, I had a couple of people that I suspected, but I really had genuinely not the faintest clue. And I suspect that first time readers are in the same place. Like, who did this thing? The end.
Now he's going to email himself to one lucky close reader.
Who's going to show up and not, they'll have one of listened to it yet. So they'll be so confused. Email. There's an app for this.
Do it during dinner.
Yeah, exactly. All of a sudden, Tim's sitting there eating pot roast with you.
Yeah.
Hope you like pot roast, Tim.
Hello, close reader.
Is that pad thai? Angelina, final thoughts.
I'm just super impressed at what a master Christie is, because I do remember the ending and I'm thinking, man, I know the ending and I can't see how this is going to be unraveled. It is extremely well done. And her touch is very subtle in terms of what the real clues are. And the other thing is that I'm a great lover of form. That's one of the things that gets me most excited about a book. And so I'm just delighted to see her drawing attention to all the things that I say are in a detective novel and, and kind of playing with it and exaggerating it. And I just love that. I feel like they're looking at the camera and being like, nope, can't be her because it's too much obvious, or her alibi would be such and such. I love it. I love it.
And it's always fun to see it unravel, I guess, or ravel.
The knot will unravel.
See things come together, and like the puzzle be, that's the better metaphor, the puzzle pieces be fitted together. One of the best things about a good mystery story is the satisfaction that comes with finishing it. Not just that you figured out who did it, and so you stay up all night reading under your covers with a flashlight, but the satisfaction of not just knowing who the solution, but the way that it's done.
Yeah.
The whole experience of it. Otherwise, we'd all just read to the back of the book and see it, right? Mm-hmm. So you read this, you read the beginning, and then you read the end. But what's satisfying about it is the experience, the process, the journey of you know, being with the detective.
And we know he's got a worthy adversary, so the stakes are high here.
The perfect crime.
It definitely looks like the perfect crime.
All right, well, let's talk about the next book.
Ooh, I'm excited.
So when I mentioned it to Angelina, she's like, wait, we talked about that?
I swear y'all are making this up. I have no memory of this.
Tim, we've talked about this, right?
I don't know. I don't know what the book
is. David dreamed that he told the two of us what the
Angelina,
next book is.
Angelina was in the doorway to my office and we talked about it. She just doesn't remember it.
No memory.
So
Graham made my coffee. Who knows what was in it? I remember nothing.
It being, we'll be finishing the next book around Christmas time. Given that we'll be starting this next book in mid-November, given that we have not done a Shakespeare play in a long time, I thought let's do Twelfth Night.
We did talk about this.
Okay, good. So that's what I'm thinking. Let's do Twelfth Night. We'll do an episode on each act. There'll be lots of great time to read things together, to perform it together, to let Tim talk about staging and all those kind of things. And then, of course, Twelfth Night is a good, you know, good if not stereotypical book to read right through the Christmas season. It's a good comedy. And Angelina, you've never read that one, right?
I have never read it.
Twelfth Night is definitely one of my favorites. Tim, have you read it?
I have.
Do you like it?
I do like it. It's not my favorite, but I do like it. It's a very, very good play.
And there's a good movie of it from 1999, which we can tie into a conversation as well. So have you seen the movie?
I have not seen. I've seen a movie. It was a full uncut version. I think it was done probably in the 80s, like one of those BBC made for television.
There's a good one with Patrick Stewart and Helena Bonham Carter and a bunch of people. I think 99. So,
David, you know what might be? I have a conviction about Shakespeare. I think maybe we've talked about this on the air before. My conviction is Shakespeare is not meant to be read. I mean, he was meant to be read by his actors. Shakespeare is meant to be performed. I wonder if we could all watch the same production, because that would give us not just the play to talk about, not just the text to talk about, but also the performances. If you don't want to go in that direction, I totally get it. But
no, I'm good with that. I mean, I would say let's watch the movie.
Yeah. I'd love that.
And then let's talk one act at a time. There's five acts in the play, so let's discuss one act each week. And we'll maybe what we need to do is pick out a couple of scenes that we can read together and discuss how they are important within that act, and then we can talk about how they're interpreted within the performance in the movie.
I love that.
I think there's a good structure for us there, because you can't talk about every scene in a Shakespeare. You know, in an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So if we choose one or two scenes that are key to each act, and then read some of the parts together, and then discuss the performance in the movie, like I think that's a good structure for us to go forth with. So are we agreed then?
Agreed.
Angelina?
I'm in.
All right. That way we're not just doing all quote modern novels, and we can, you know, maybe Matt Bianco will actually listen. I mean, he'll skip the banter, but.
No, I'm excited. I'm excited to do this one. I'm all happy to read a new book.
So, okay. So, Twelfth Night, we'll begin that after we do our movie tie-in episode of Murder on the Orient Express. So,
which I'm so excited because we're going to see a movie. My daughter is actually reading the book.
No, nice. Yeah, she took the copy I gave
you. She did. She took the official Close Reads copy from me when I got home and said, oh, I'm going to read this. But she didn't want to read it if I wrote notes in it. So,
well, thanks to everyone who's been listening, of course, and certainly thanks to all the patrons who have been contributing on Patreon. We'll do more polls up there. All of Angelina and Tim's past conference talks that have been edited so far are available there. So if you are a Patreon of any level, you can go over there and subscribe. You can use the little link there to add it to your podcast app if you want to do that. So when we post new ones, they'll show up there.
And I heard Tim's latest talk from last weekend was dynamite. You don't want to miss that.
Dynamite, huh?
Dynamite.
Strong word.
That was the exact phrase.
It's an explosive word.
Dynamite.
Dynamite?
Dynamite.
Well, congratulations on the dynamite talk.
I have given the rest of that talk already to a dozen people. It's like in a high request.
You've done what?
I've had a dozen people ask me for the text of that thing, and I've already.
No, Tim. You tell them the way to get that talk is to become a sponsor of the show.
$2 a month.
Well, I figured the people who had just heard it, it's not going to be the only. I mean, they've already heard it, so.
Yeah, fair enough.
But if they want to own it forever and ever.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. They need to become a sponsor.
So don't forget to subscribe. If you have not subscribed to Just the Close Reads feed, please do that, because eventually you're not going to be able to get this very often on just the Cersei Podcast Network feed. Not sure when, but eventually that's going to happen. So please subscribe on the Close Reads feed on whatever podcast app you use. And don't forget that coming up soon, we are going to have a season 2 of The Commons by Brian Phillips is coming up. And he's going to be doing 10 episodes over 10 straight weeks, beginning with November 1st, which is All Saints Day.
Oh, nice.
And each episode is going to be covering one key figure, or maybe on occasion two, but key figures within church history. So the first episode is going to be an interview that he conducted with Wes Callahan about John Chrysostom. He's going to talk about the nice. Cappadocian Fathers. He's going to talk about the Puritans. He's going to talk about the Reformation a bit. He's going to talk about Augustine. He's going to talk about hymnody in the church history, all kinds of great things over those 10 weeks. So 10 consecutive weeks starting November 1st. So that's going to be season 2 of that. Then coming up in the spring, we are going to be bringing you a show by Matt Bianco, which is called The Divided Line. And that is going to be where Matt does 10 episodes explore, and they're all going to be exploring Plato. So as he writes his dissertation on Plato, he's going to be interviewing different people along with his research, people like David Hicks, professors at St. John's College, all different, you know, scholars and experts and things like that, as they kind of work their way through 10 episodes on Plato. So that's called The Divided Line. That's coming up this spring. And then soon we're going to be bringing back the Ask Andrew podcast. Those are going to be Andrew Kern responding or answering questions on, basically it's kind of going to be a definitions show. So what are the seven liberal arts? Things like that, where he takes 10 minutes to respond quickly to questions about key definitions in classical education. So there's lots of great content coming. Of course, you can listen to Forma, the interview podcast that we do. Last week, we interviewed Adam Andrews on his article about The Great Gatsby. So there's just tons of really good content coming out and already available to you. So thanks for listening, as you have been, and be sure to be on the lookout for those things. I guess that is it, though. So, Tim, Angelina, any final words for our listeners out there?
Nope.
Can't wait to see who did it.
All right.
And why and how.
For Angelina Stanford, for Tim McIntosh, and for all of us here at the Circe Institute, thanks so much for listening to Close Reads on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. Talk to you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.